There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abouhul, Annabelle Corton, and the rest of the Festival of Literature team.
Only on DubaiEye 103.8.
Hello, if you've just tuned in, you're in time for our big question of the day, which is which book is going to win the Man Booker Prize this year? We were just talking about Paul Auster's rather lengthy 4321. At 1,000, how many pages was it, James?
1,057.
1,057, not that you're counting. It took him, what was it? He worked on the book 7 days a week for 3 years and he wrote it in longhand. Can you believe that? His arm must have been very tired. We've had some great texts come in as well, haven't we, Isabel?
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with one of the listeners. The book that they loved, that made them happy, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by Ken Kesey, an absolute classic. Many people would have seen the film, but do read the book as well. And it's a great adaptation, but nothing like the book to get behind Big Chief Bromden. And It's just an incredible book,
If you'd like to win some books today, we do have some competitions as well, which is why everybody's really texting in. So if you want to win a copy of Arundhati Roy's The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, please text in the book that makes you happy. If you'd like to win a copy of Paul Auster's 4321, not for the faint-hearted, only if you've got a lot of time on your hands, just saying, what's the longest book that you have enjoyed?
Okay, I'm going to give it's barely marked copy of George Saunders' Lincoln in the Bardo. If you want to win this, it's an A, B or C question. So Isabel got the Man Booker Prize winner right once. Now, was the book A, Life of Pi by Jan Martel, B, Room by Emma Donoghue, or C, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara? So you've just got to say A, B or C. Which time did I predict the Booker Prize winner?
I know this one and I can't say.
Yes. So it's a question, 4001, it's either A, B or C. You've got a 33% chance of winning this wonderful Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders,
which is going to cause quite a lot of debate when we get to that later. Just saying. Also, Paul Auster, I think, you know, whatever you think of the book, he's a great speaker. I found that when I was looking up interviews of him. I found him a very engaging speaker. Here he is talking about his weighty tome.
You've landed us after so many sort of gamine, elegant books with this kind of lap cracker. 900 odd pages.
Don't drop it on your foot. That's the only advice I can give you.
Paul Auster's new novel had to be big because it imagines one man's life four different ways. The writer's been preoccupied with the unexpected turns our lives can take since a tragedy involving a thunderstorm at summer camp when he was just 14.
The boy directly in front of me, in other words, his feet were about that far from my head, as he was halfway through the fence, lightning struck the barbed wire, electrocuted him on the spot. I didn't know he was dead. I had never seen a dead person. So I crawled beside him and I pulled him into the meadow and I stayed with him for an hour trying to warm him up. And that was the moment when I understood that anything can happen to anybody at any time. And it's an experience that has haunted me all my life. I've thought about it probably every day. It was the single most important thing that ever happened to me.
The multiple lives of Auster's protagonist, Ferguson, unfold against the events of the mid-20th century.
Those were the only two subjects that seemed to exist anymore, Ferguson wrote in a letter to his aunt and uncle in California. The expanding bloodshed in Vietnam and the civil rights movement at home. White America at war with the yellow people of Southeast Asia, white America in conflict with its own black citizens, who were more and more in conflict with themselves. For the movement that had already split into factions was splitting further into factions of factions, and perhaps even factions of factions of factions, everyone in conflict with everyone else, the lines drawn so sharply that few dared step over them anymore. Well, we seem to be in that state right now in the United States again. And it is eerie how 50 years later, we're living through a new wave of racial problems and another divided country. And and suddenly, after the election, a new wave of activism that is had not happened in this country, in our country, since that period of my book, the 60s.
Political leaders come and go, but revisiting the 50s and 60s for his new novel has encouraged a tendency in Oster to take the long view.
I mean, the big things that we go through in life, I think, finally are the deaths of the people we love. But everyone goes through this, and it's wrenching. It tears us apart. And as you get older, you start living with ghosts. And I'm surrounded by ghosts now. I talk to the dead as much as I talk to the living. These are the great aches and sorrows of any human life, is saying goodbye to people you don't want to say goodbye to. So what can we do? This is how things work. You know, you have to accept it.
That was Paul Auster talking about his book 4321, which is on the shortlist for the Man Booker Prize, which is what we're discussing today. We've had some wonderful texts come in, everybody wanting to read the books that we're giving away today. One person in particular, or two people, are actually hedging their bets. When we ask you a multiple choice question, A, B or C, that doesn't mean you can text in A, B and C in separate
text. Well, I think Paul Auster would probably think that was with his four versions of 4321. Maybe today we will allow it. So keep your texts coming in. That was to give the right answer, A, B or C. So I once predicted the winner of the Man Booker Prize. Was it A, Life of Pi, B, Room, or C, A Little Life? One of those is the right answer, and two of them are wrong. So text in your answers to 4001, and please put your names, and I'm going to be gifting you a copy of Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders.
I just want to read out one of the ones here. Beyond Happiness by Anthony Seldon makes me happy. The God of Small Things, which we were talking about earlier, the book that makes me happy. Someone says Opal Plumstead. I think that's
Jacqueline Wilson.
It's the longest book I've ever read.
Not that long. Not compared to 1,000 Paul Auster.
We have a special birthday to mention as well. On the 16th of October, it would actually have been Oscar Wilde's birthday. So it's time for this.
Literary Moment, Milestones in Literary History.
I have a selection of some of his best quotes because he is one of the wittiest mans of all time. There is only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about. The truth is rarely pure and never simple. True friends stab you in the front. Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. That's my personal favourite. And we are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. And finally, I can resist everything except temptation. So there you go. Happy birthday, Oscar Wilde, for the 16th of October. And now we need to move on to Ali Smith's Autumn. So who's read that one?
James and Isabel.
And me as well.
Oh, and Annabelle. Sorry, and Annabelle. So do you want to start, Annabelle?
Yeah, sure.
With Autumn by Ali Smith.
Well, I've read Ali Smith before, and I absolutely loved How to Be Both. Did you enjoy How to Be Both?
No.
Okay.
I liked the cinema
really?
One. There was one, the theatre one before that. I can't remember.
I didn't read
was,
that one.
Well, anyway, it was shortlisted for the book as well. Yeah, I didn't like How to Be Both. It was a bit of Paul Auster type of thing, that there were two, we were in the past or we were in the present, and it was all a bit woozy.
We were messed with. Too much.
Yeah. Oh, no, I really like that because, I mean, if you haven't read How to Be Both, you could pick up a version of the book and it could either start with the modern version of the book or the one that was set centuries ago, and you never knew what you were going to get. And I thought that was quite a nice gimmick. But reading
a gimmick, I agree. It was a gimmick.
I liked it, though. But reading an Ali Smith novel in general is a bit like doing a cryptic crossword, I feel.
Mm.
And I felt like that with Autumn. You said about feeling messed with. I felt like I was being messed with in Autumn. And I felt like it's a brilliant novel. I'm glad I read it. She's original. You know, there's no denying that. But I don't think I completely understood it, though. And I don't think that that's entirely my fault either, to the point where I'm really confused by all the reviews calling it post-Brexit novel brilliance. Because I don't think... I thought that was just a bit that was woven amongst the story. I don't think that was actually a real focus of the book. And I don't think that the focus is actually very clear. I felt like she was firing lots of arrows. They were hitting a target, but none of them were really hitting the bullseye. And I ended up thinking, okay, it's an interesting novel, but I didn't really get anything out of it.
Mm. I mean, it's the first in a four-part seasonal, so she's actually going to go through the other seasons as well. And, yeah, I mean, I approached this book with trepidation, having had to endure, and that's how I would put it, having had to endure previous Ali Smith novels. What I was surprised about was how much I actually enjoyed this book, certainly the first half of it. Now, it's not a huge book, but the first half of it, I think there are parts of it that are unremittingly brilliant, actually. And I think that her way with the language, she's very, very playful. She's poetic in parts. But she wrote this post-Brexit. And she wrote this in anger. And you can sometimes feel that anger leaping from the page. You can feel how upset she is about what's happened, principally in relation to the relationship in the UK amongst people who've come from elsewhere. So the immigrants, the people who've come from outside and how they are being treated and how they are being talked about and forgetting to see that these people have actually contributed to this society. They have been here for two, three, four generations, and now they're being made to feel foreign, in the words. And you feel that, you know, she's a very talented writer writing with anger about an important subject, and she has, you know, she has these facilities. She has this facility with words, mm-hmm. And there is a chapter in particular. There's one chapter about Brexit and about how people feel about it. There's that Brexit chapter. And I felt when I was reading that, I felt, do you know what I would love to do? If I actually had the money, what I would love to do is I'd love to take billboards around the UK and I would actually take that chapter and I would post that chapter on billboards around the UK. Because it's written with such, as I say, such facility, so brilliantly explains how people feel about it, mm. And what they were doing when they were voting and what's going on in the UK at the moment. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. So there's the first half of the book, and I thought, oh, this is a shoo-in. She's obviously going to win the Booker Prize because of this. And then the second half, I just got irritated. As you were saying, you know, Annabelle, bits of it where I just felt disconnected. I thought it was meandering. She was then going off. I mean, the criticism I would have of her that she's quite self-indulgent, and she sort of lost the plot is what I would say. But there are parts of it that are I think are just so excellent. Parts of it are, I mean, phenomenal. So I would absolutely recommend people to read it. And I think that it may win. I think the Ali Smith book might win.
Yes. I hope not, but I think you might be right. I think there is a feeling that she's always been the bridesmaid and never the bride. Her writing is absolutely fantastic. She is a very clever, a very polished writer. I read this book and it was not a difficult read. It was a read that I could go. But if you ask me after I'd finished it, what was it about? I found it hard to actually remember. And then I was thinking, well, why can't I remember better what actually happened in the book? And it was a meandering sort of almost not going anywhere book. And I don't know that is the kind of book that I believe should be winning the Booker. I believe we're going to have to take a Brexit break on that and be back with more about Autumn and Ali Smith after this.
From John Ronson to James Dashner, Jane Austen to Zadie Smith, this is Talking of Books on Dubai I 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Isabel, and co-host over the other side of the studio is the lovely Annabel. And we're reviewing the 2017 Man Booker Prize shortlist, which in my humble opinion is one of the best shortlists we've ever had. So real thank you to the Booker judges. I don't believe it's contrived. I don't believe that they've got three men and three women that they chose that way, or that they've got Americans and not Americans or whatever. I just think that that happens to be the novels that they like best. We're actually discussing one of the shortlisted books by British writer Ali Smith, who's been on the shortlist twice before, and her book Autumn. I'm just going to read you a little bit just from the first page. It was the worst of times. It was the worst of times again. That's the thing about things. They fall apart. Always have, always will. It's in their nature. So an old man washes up on a shore. He looks like a punctured football with its stitching split. The leather kind that people kicked 100 years ago. The sea's been rough. It has taken the shirt off his back. Naked as the day I was born are the words in the head he moves on its neck, but it hurts to. So try not to move the head. What's this in his mouth? Grit? It's sand. It's under his tongue. He can feel it. He can hear it grinding when his teeth move against each other. And so on. I mean, she writes so able to imagine exactly what that person is lying on the beach and how it feels, and immediately draws you in. I mean, she is an amazing writer, but I like a book that leaves a mark on me. And if you ask me about it 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I could immediately be back inside that novel and the characters. And within 2 or 3 weeks of reading Autumn, I'd forgotten what she was trying to tell me. I'd forgotten what the characters meant, although it was a lovely read. And therefore, for me, it's not my choice of a winner. And just because she's been shortlisted before should not be, you know, it should not be a sympathy vote. What do you think?
Yeah, I haven't read the book, but definitely for me, the books that I have read on the list, they stayed with me. So if you're not thinking about a book weeks after, I feel that it really shouldn't win the prize.
And I agree with what you said, James, about the first half, when I was actually really enjoying it. But then I lost the plot, and I lost the enthusiasm for the tale that she was telling. And whether it's because she became politicised, whether it's because who knows what. But it just did not work for me in the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should tell people that the characters, there's this character, Elizabeth Demand, which is quite an interesting name in itself. And her relationship with this character called Daniel Gluck. So the character that you just described is Daniel Gluck, dead. Mm. And then the relationship between Elizabeth Demand and Daniel Gluck over time. And they had she had known this character when he was when she was a child. He was a key influence on her, and he was an immigrant. He was somebody who had come to the UK. And it's about, you know, the UK as it is now, what's happening in terms of how people look after old people as well. And what happens is that the tale is told, and I just, exactly as you were describing, Isabel, I was getting to the end of the book, and I was going, why am I so irritated? And that's actually how I felt. I felt irritated by this book, because she was going into her little riffs. It's a bit like a sort of a jazz artist, if you like, you know, a self-indulgent jazz artist. You know that they're really good at what they're doing, but they're doing it for the sake of doing it rather than advancing a story or a
point. Exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Self-indulgent jazz artist. That's what it feels like. I think that's a
fantastic description. Yeah. That is fantastic. And she's indulging herself. Don't indulge yourself as a writer. You need to keep your reader. You know, I can remember reading a wonderful piece by a famous writer who said that we are not complete until we have a reader. And that is so true that, you know, writer writes, but not in isolation. You know, we are the other part of the equation that they need to make that book come to life. Because until it lives within our spirit and our soul and our minds, it's not. It's dead. It's nothing. It's meaningless.
I will say, though, that I think a strength of all the books on the shortlist and on the longlist are that they don't seem to be thinking about, OK, what do I need to write for my reader? And I think that the joy of the Booker Prize is discovering those gems that come about when writers take everything out of the equation and write something completely new and completely fresh. I think Ali Smith did that. And I think I felt exactly the same way that you did, Isabel, that I don't think it's going to stay with me. And I love the way that she writes, and she hits the nail on the head every once in a while, and then she loses me as I'm reading it. And I like unanswered questions. I like novels that leave me thinking, but she had too many unanswered questions. I need a basic string of plot points to anchor the story. Maybe that's just
but
me.
Even if they're unanswered questions, Elmet definitely has unanswered questions. I love that. I want to know. It's unfinished business, because life is unfinished business. And it's not that. It's just that she's lost the engagement with me. And yes, I don't want a writer to write for me, the reader, but without me, it's unfinished business. It is unfinished business. So they need to engage me, and not me, but any reader. That's what books do. That's what great books do, that they stay with you. And you can, I'm sure if we asked everyone here in the studio today, remember a book that you read when you were 10 or 12 or 14, all of us will have been impacted. No matter what age we are today, we will remember where we were when we read that and what it felt like. And that is what, for me, that's what matters, is that I will be left with, I will become more than I was before I read the book by what I have read. Somehow or other, they've added to me as a person with their experience now living in me.
Ironically, one of my favourite quotes about reading and the magic of it that you were just talking about actually was in this book, whatever I thought of the book as a whole. She said, she's reading from A Tale of Two Cities, and she says, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness, it was the epoch of belief, it was the season of darkness, it was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. The words had acted like a charm. They'd released it all in seconds. They'd made everything happening stand just far enough away. It was nothing less than magic. Who needs a passport? Who am I? Where am I? What am I? I'm reading. And I think that was probably my favourite quote of the whole book. I thought, yes, that's why we read.
But that's Charles Dickens.
The first part is.
The first part is, yeah.
And
yes.
Then
the rest
I like
is,
her interpretation yes. of it as
yeah.
well.
Yes.
But interesting that Paul Auster and Ali Smith, mm-hmm. You know, have these quite a lot of literary allusions to Dickens.
What we need to do now is we need to move on to one that Marna's quite fond of, which is Exit West by Mohsin Hamid. And Yara as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so Man, do you want to just tell us a little bit about Exit West?
So Exit West is a story about a young couple who live in an unnamed country somewhere in the Middle East or maybe in Asia, and they meet at the same time where their city is going through unrest and there's, you know, it's on the brink of civil war, and they decide that they want to leave. And at the same time, and this is where the twist sort of happens, is that these sort of portals or these doors begin to appear in different parts of the cities. And if you walk through these doors, you end up in a different country, in a different city, all the way across the world. And so all of a sudden, there is this fast-forward mass immigration of all these different people from different countries that are experiencing something similar. And you see what happens to this couple who are traveling around the world as part refugees, part immigrants, and how they're trying to rebuild their lives together. And you see how this journey changes them and how it affects their relationship. And I think it's interesting when you read books, because I think we end up liking books that we might relate to, or we might feel sympathy for the characters, or something that we might have experienced. I grew up in New Zealand after living in Dubai for a long time, so reading their experiences as immigrants really struck me. It's something that I experienced myself, and I saw my friends experience as well, which is, I think, why I really, really enjoyed this book. And I think it's actually, I think, the shortest book from the Man Booker shortlist. And I think Mohsin Hamid does so much in that short amount of space in the book that when you look back, you think, did I really cover all this ground and all these ideas? And I think immigration and refugees, I think, is one of the biggest issues that our generation is dealing with right now. So I think from that point of view, it's a very important book to read. And I think from the very first sentence of the book, I was struck, and I think it really talks, the first sentence really encapsulates the whole idea of the book. So the sentence begins, in a city swollen by refugees, but still mostly at peace, or at least not yet openly at war, a young man met a young woman in a classroom and did not speak to her for many days. I think that first line to me has all these ideas I just talked about, love and politics and what happens to them after. So I think, what did you think, Yara?
Yeah, I really love this book. I think that he's a writer that has this knack of writing books within a political context. So The Reluctant Fundamentalist is a book that he wrote before this that was also nominated, I think, for the Man Booker before. Even though initially I didn't really love the idea of the portals and it was a bit Narnia-like and seemed to not fit comfortably in the story, I think so many stories about refugees are about the physical hardships of the journey, whereas he focuses beautifully on the kind of emotional context that Mann's talking about, of having to leave your homeland, having to leave loved ones behind, about starting a new life in a different place where people are hostile to you. I think he makes us think about, what if this was me? What if this was you? What if you had to go through this experience? Which I think is a very important subject. And what I loved most is how unconventional Nadia, the female character, is. He sets her up at the beginning to seem quite conservative, and then he pulls that rug from under your feet. And so I loved Nadia in particular. I thought she was complex and unexpected, and really, I thought she brought the book to life.
Beautifully put. Yeah. We'll be back with an interview with Mohsen Hamid and more on Mohsen Hamid's Exit West right after this.
From Stephen King to Madhul Jaffrey, Anthony Horowitz to Kevin Kwan, this is Talking of Books.
On Dubai I 103.8.
Welcome back. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Isabel Carry On Talking when she thinks at the mic.
I forgot the red light.
We are talking about the Man Booker Prize and who we think is going to win it. We're just talking about Mohsen Hamid's Exit West as well. Here he is on Late Night on Seth Meyers talking about his book.
Do you find that different places receive your writing in different ways?
Different people receive writing in different ways. So I like to tell a story about this guy in Washington, D.C., an American guy, blonde hair, blue eyes, comes up after a reading of The Reluctant Fundamentalist and says, you know, this novel's about me. And The Reluctant Fundamentalist is about a Pakistani guy who grows a beard and goes back to Pakistan after working in New York City.
Yeah.
So I looked at him, I looked at the book in his hands, and it was my book, and I said, you know, how so? And he said, well, I went to an Ivy League school, I worked on Wall Street, and I quit my job, and I'm a yoga instructor. And that's when I actually realized that The Reluctant Fundamentalist is actually the story of a liberal arts kid who goes to work and stops working. And so, yeah, people react in different ways. You can't predict.
Yeah, I still would rather read your version than his. Yeah. So this is interesting. This is about a refugee couple in an unnamed country who sort of escaping their country and traveling around trying to find a home. And there's a great amount of realism to it. The character is very real. The dialogue is real. And yet there's this one element, which is the way they go from one country to the other is through sort of magical doors. I feel like that might be the best description of it. Yeah?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so what brought you to use this element of sort of fairy tale into this very real story?
Well, partly I think the doors sort of already exist. Like, I was in Pakistan. I feel like I've sort of stepped through a magical door to arrive sitting next to you. Distance has collapsed in our world. So we're pressed close up against each other through technology. But I wanted to focus on what happens before you move. You know, what leads someone to leave where they live? What's the enormous sorrow or pain? And then what happens when you get there, which is most of your life? Crossing the Rio Grande or crossing the Mediterranean is a tiny little piece of that story. The real story is all of us experience this pain before we move, and then something that happens afterwards.
I love that the fact that distance has collapsed in our world is what he said. The fact that we're always in proximity to what's happening on the news, and I think these doors are a way of him saying that we are so close to each other, even though we are so far apart, and we cannot escape the discussions that we're having at the moment. You were saying that the female character was something that you really liked, Yara. Can you tell us a bit more about her?
Yeah, I'm going to read you a bit. So, like I said, Nadia, when you first meet her, seems quite conservative. But actually, you find out she's quite bold and a risk taker, and quite the opposite of Saeed. And this is part of the differences between them that you see when they've moved to other lands. But I'm going to read you a section that explains Nadia to you. But then all around her, she saw all these people of different colors and all these different attires, and she was relieved. Better here than there, she thought. And it occurred to her that she had been stifled in the place of her birth for virtually her entire life, that its time for her had passed and a new time was here. And fraught or not, she relished this like the wind in her face on a hot day when she rode her motorcycle and lifted the visor of her helmet and embraced the dust and the pollution and the little bugs that sometimes went into your mouth and made you recoil, even spit, but after spitting, grin, and grin with a wildness. So Nadia rides a motorcycle. And in comparison to Saeed, who I think, when he moves to another land, gravitates towards people of his own kind and wants to find that connection of home again, she finds the experience of moving very freeing. And you see that kind of distancing between them happen in their reactions to moving.
And this is exactly what I thought when I was reading the book, because that's exactly what happens to immigrants when they leave their home country. It's always that split between the people who want to retain where they're from and the people who want to experience a new culture. And I think something as well that he does is very interesting towards the end of the book, and this is not a spoiler alert, is that all of a sudden we see, because the whole time we're seeing all these different minorities in countries where they're trying to live, but then all of a sudden you see Europeans who are also leaving their countries to go to different places. And he describes they're a Swedish family, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And we instantly think, well, hang on a second, anyone could be a refugee, anyone can be an immigrant as well. Because this whole time we're thinking it's just people from that are, you know, brown or people from countries that have civil unrest. But really, it could be anyone, which I thought was a really clever way of doing it.
Yeah. And that's what people forget, that actually America is made up, you know, the indigenous people are a tiny, tiny minority. Yeah. Of the immigrants that went to America, to Canada, to Australia, to New Zealand. You don't have to go very far back to find that people have always traveled and have always been taking something from where they've come and then, you know, adapting it to be something in the new country. But I really like Saeed as well. I felt he was a genuine gentleman. You know, he was a very gentle person, and he absolutely adored Nadia, probably adored her more than she adored him. But because she was female, I think she was so emancipated by moving to another place that the impact on her was much greater than it was on him. He also had the issue of leaving his father, which he was very much a family man. She'd actually got rid of her family in many ways before she left, by, you know, deciding she was going to live on her own and all of these things, which were quite shocking in the scenario that Mahsen Hamid paints of where she was from. So I think he writes beautifully. The characters are totally believable. He explains that through the doors, that actually he gets on a plane to go somewhere, and that's like going through a door and then you land somewhere else, which is a great analogy. But I can't get that I would open the bathroom door to go through this door and I would then be somewhere else yet. Maybe that's a technology that's coming. Maybe he's ahead of his time. And I think it's a great book, and I wouldn't be upset but not so upset if this wins. It's just that there's one on this list. If that wins, I might have to take a break from reading, I think.
There's something I want us to talk a little bit about, and that's this idea of readability. Now, the language that Mohsin Hamid uses An Exit West, I'd say, is perhaps, I mean, would you agree it's a little bit more accessible than what Ali Smith does with her language and the way that she's creative?
Not really.
No.
No, I think they're both incredibly literary writers. And a literary writer, like Charles Dickens, should be accessible.
Yeah.
I think they're both accessible. There's one that is not accessible.
Which one?
I'm not saying.
You're not going to say
I'm
yet?
I'm not going to
okay,
say.
All right. I'm bringing this up because 2011 was a very controversial year in the Man Booker Prize. Mm. So it's not something that we've talked very much about.
Who won in 2011?
I can't remember.
You should ask Rob Mitchell.
Yeah.
He guessed it.
Yeah. If anybody knows the answer to that, please text it in. Mm. One of the judges
Elaine
said...
Elaine is going to be finding out for us in... record time.
One of the judges said that what they were looking for were readable books. They actually said that to everybody, and it upset a lot of people for various reasons.
Wasn't that the head of the ex-head of the MI5, the lady who was the judge, and she was the one that said that she wanted books to be accessible? She was the judge that year, so she was Stella. Can you remember her name, Stella? Who is it?
Julian Barnes, Sense of an Ending.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. And right. Yes. Yeah. Can you find out who was on the shortlist? Mm. Because that was not the... it was such a depressing book. I wouldn't have said that was accessible.
Andrew Motion said the Booker should not become a theatre in which a split is opened up between quality and readability, which I completely agree with. That is a pernicious and dangerous thing.
But is quality and readability not... can they not be combined? You know, does it mean that Charles Dickens, because he was readable, there was not quality? Thomas Hardy, you know, all of the great...
And it's all subjective
as
well.
Is quality meant to be inaccessible in reading?
I think there's this idea as well that if it's more literary, it's more up there, it's more intellectual, it's more of quality.
For a few, for the gifted few.
For a few. Whereas if something is more readable, accessible, it's not considered high literature or something. And I remember a great quote by Dickens that when he was accused of making caricatures of his characters, he says something along the lines of, well, it's really difficult actually to make a good caricature, which I think is really true. And I think that's why we want to read, because we get engaged with characters and with plot, and if they're not written in a way that's accessible to many people, how else are we going to be getting a lot more people to read?
My favourite on the year that Julian Barnes won with The Sense of an Ending was Jamrat's Menagerie by Carol Birch, which was an amazing historical fiction, but based on Jamrak and what happened and the whole character. So it was fantasy, but it was wonderful. Mm. And it was such a engaging read compared to The Sense of an Ending, which was sad. It was just depressing. The whole book was depressing. It's been made into a film, hasn't it?
I don't know.
Yes, it has.
Talking about style and accessibility, often a book that comes up is a book called Ulysses by James Joyce. Now, Yara's rolling her eyes. Ali Smith, we've already talked about Autumn, but she does have something very interesting to say about style. She's a great speaker. Have a listen.
Style versus content. How should the novelist approach the novel? That's what I've got to talk about. Should. This word should, which turned up yesterday as well, should. I'm really uncomfortable with the word should. It's anything to do with writing anything. Anyway, point one, what's it all about versus what's it all about? Fight, fight, fight. In the style corner, a battered old copy of Ulysses. In the content corner, the Brazilian writer Paulo Coelho. Writers go wrong when they focus on form, not content, Coelho told a San Paulo newspaper earlier this month. He explained to the paper that his ability to make complicated things simple was what made him a great modern writer. One of the books that caused great harm, he said, was James Joyce's Ulysses. The problem with Ulysses, it's pure style. There is nothing there. Stripped down, Ulysses is a twit. No, or did he mean Ulysses is a tweet? Now that sounds to me more likely and handy too, because it lets us add new technological reference to the same old, age-old fight. The great, rollicking world of invention, the book whose rewrite of tradition, whose fusion of ordinary, legendary, fiction and real made the everyday and the man in the street an epic, and vice versa, a tweet. I think Joyce would have made a really good tweeter. It being his habit to transform characters, whether fictional human beings or the letters that form words, into something unexpectedly expansive. Nothing is harmful to literature except censorship, and that almost never stops literature going where it wants to go either, because literature has a way of surpassing everything that blocks it and growing stronger for the exercise. Personally, I don't care if everybody or nobody reads Ulysses, or if nobody or everybody reads 50 Shades of Coelho. There's room in the world for all of us. We are large. We contain multitudes.
There you go. We are large. We contain multitudes. And lots of arguments about the Booker Prize. More when we come back. Keep texting into 4001.
From Stephen King to Madhu Jaffrey, Anthony Horowitz to Kevin Kwan, this is Talking of Books.
On Dubai i103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books and the Man Booker Shortlist Spectacular Show, where we devote all of our show over to the six books that have made this year's shortlist. The prize will be announced on the 17th of October, and I think all of us will be up. It will be an all-nighter waiting to know who's won, because we're all very divided on who we think will win or who we want to win. But we're now coming on to a book that 120% does not get my vote. George Saunders, Lincoln in the Bardo. So I'm going to hand it over. I'll let him have the first go at it. James Mullen, who is a good predictor of who's going to win, and he can tell us why I think he likes it.
I don't just like it. I love this book. So we're going to have a proper good Barney on this particular book. When I lifted it up, I went through it, read the first few pages, and then I went, is this the format? Is this what's going to happen for the rest of this book? Because there are a bunch of voices speaking, and you get little paragraphs throughout. So I flicked through the book and I went, oh goodness, I've got whatever 300 pages of this stuff to get through. And that's actually how I felt after the first sort of five or six pages. And then I thought, well, I've got to do my Booker duty. I've got to plow through this stuff. And as I began to plow through it, I actually began to enjoy it. And I think I've got to tell you a little bit about what the book is. Basically, George Saunders has taken a real-life incident. So it's Abraham Lincoln, and his son died. His 11 or 12-year-old son died. And when he was interred in this mausoleum, he went for, I think it was 10 or 11 nights, to go and visit the body, if you like, in the mausoleum. And nothing is known about that. So what he's done is he's taken that particular incident and he's woven a what-if around it. And he's taken this Tibetan idea of the bardo. So this is the bardo that's referred to in the title. And what it is, it's like a sort of a restroom, if you like, where spirits are before it's decided which way they're going to go. Are they going to go this way? Are they going to go up? Are they going to go down? But they're in this area.
So it's a Tibetan version of purgatory.
Correct. Yeah, it's a bit like this. And you have all of these spirits, if you like. So you have these voices of these characters that come in and are observing what's happening here. So it's a very, very odd premise, really, if you like it. And if you don't go with it, which is clearly what happened with Isabel, then you could find it an incredibly irritating read. I can understand exactly why somebody wouldn't get this. But what got me about it was exactly the originality of this. That's what got me. And I'll tell you what also was, it was the humor of this as well.
Can we talk about the voices, the number of voices that we have in the book as well?
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the audio version of the book, Annabelle. So, you know,
yeah.
What, 166
so
voices?
So they've actually broken a Guinness World Record with the audiobook for this. They thought, because there's so many different, you know, spirits and different characters, rather than have somebody try and do all these different accents and create different characters, they've got 166 voices recording the audiobook. George Saunders is actually talking about the way he laid out the book as well, almost like text messages, but instead of the name being above the text, it's actually below it. Here he is talking about how he formatted his book.
Hi, I'm George Saunders, author of Lincoln and the Bardo. Lincoln and the Bardo was a novel based on something I heard years ago, a story that Lincoln had visited the grave of his recently deceased son, Willie. He was so grief-stricken that he actually went to the graveyard and held the body. Years ago, I had worked on a book set in a graveyard, and I'd kind of modeled it after the then-new chat line thing, you know, where you hit a person's name and then some text, person name, text. So I just reversed it. I just put the text and then the character's name at the bottom for that other book about ghosts. And that was kind of cool because you could have a number of different formats. You could have a monologue. You could have two ghosts talking back and forth. You could have two ghosts talking back and forth about an action that was actually taking place. So I kind of abandoned that book. But when I started this one, that format came to mind. So I decided to use that. And then in this book, the other missing sort of leg of the tripod is that a lot of the stuff that makes this story moving, at least to me, has to do with the historical context. And this was sort of at the worst moment of the Civil War. So anyway, all those things were contributing to my sense that this was a beautiful story. But the problem for a writer is, how do you get all that stuff in? So at some point, I decided to actually just quote those history books that I had read, kind of break it up, fragment it, rearrange it, make it dramatic. And then in one of those kind of interesting moments, you're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I can do it exactly the same way. I can have the text, and I can have the historical attribution right under it. So the whole book, which is 350 pages, is all made up of text quotes, whether by ghosts or historical figures, and then just a little attribution at the end. But again, that looks simple enough, but it all came out of the inherent problem of trying to dramatize a story in which really nothing happens except a walk and then a walk back. But that's what I, you know, what I love about art is that if you can get yourself in the face of a hard enough problem, then that's when the fun begins. That's when all of the things that we talk about, like character development and formal innovation and stylistic stretching, all that stuff comes, in the best case, very naturally out of a problem that you have that seems kind of impossible. So the idea that when the story puts a constraint on you, you should be really happy, because that means you're going to have to kind of break some rules to actually get the story told with the emotion that it deserves.
Hello, I've kidnapped everyone, and I'm going to get the mic. No, I'm joking. We're talking about Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders, which James Mullen is really hoping will win, and absolutely loved it. I'm just going to read you a little bit. I hate it, okay? And I'll see if I can get that hatred in my little bit of it. So this is D. Strumpet, the butler, an account of the butler Lincoln. So he went in. He said, around midnight, I entered to ask if I could bring him something. The sight of him shocked me. His hair was wild, his face pale, with signs of recent tears plainly evident. I marvelled at his agitated manner and wondered what might be the outcome if he did not find some relief. I'd recently been to visit an ironworks in the state of Pennsylvania, where a steam release valve had been demonstrated to me. The president's state put me in mind of the necessity of such an apparatus. So this is George Saunders giving you supposed eyewitness accounts of Lincoln with the tragedy of losing his son Willie. And then the unkempt gentleman was fussing over the small form now, stroking the hair, patting and rearranging the pale doll-like hands. Roger Bevins III. As the lad stood nearby, uttering many urgent entreaties for his father to look his way, fuss over and pat him, the Reverend Everly Thomas, which the gentleman appeared not to hear, Roger Bevins III. Then this already troubling and unseemly display descended to a new level of Hans Vollmann. We hear an intake of breath from the Reverend, who, appearance notwithstanding, is not easily shocked, Roger Bevins III. He's going to pick that child up, the Reverend said, Hans Vollmann. And so he did. The man lifted the tiny form out of the Roger Bevins III. So it's all these ghosts who are sort of swarming about, watching Lincoln pick up his tiny dead son from the coffin. And Willie Lincoln is obviously one of the ghosts, and his father can't see him. And I just can't see the point of it all, at all, at all, at all, at all.
I absolutely loved it, and I want to defend it, but I can't, because we need to go away.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.